Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Where you gonna run to? All on that day.
Hello and welcome to The Breakdown, brought to you by The Nation Magazine and TheNation.com. I'm Chris Hayes, Washington editor of The Nation. Each week here on The Breakdown, we take your questions via Twitter at Chris L. Hayes or via email at TheBreakdown@TheNation.com. The way it works is this. You send us questions about what's perplexing you this week in Washington, and we try to break it down.
Will I run to the rock? Please hide me, I run to the rock. Please hide me, I run to the rock. Please hide me, Lord.
Hello, welcome back to The Breakdown. We've been getting a ton of emails with questions recently, which is really encouraging. I'm glad you folks are listening and sending in emails. You can send emails to TheBreakdown@TheNation.com, which we give at the end of every broadcast. And this week, we have an email from Jeremy Beck. And Jeremy writes in to say, how does U.S. campaign finance compare to election fundraising in China, Japan, France, India, and other countries? Is our system of party competition the only one so heavily centered on backdoor lobbying, investment from business elites, and unlimited corporate funding? I thought this was a great question. A lot of times in the U.S., politics, particularly U.S. political journalists, we lose sight of the fact that there are a lot of different political systems out there that do things differently. And I thought it'd be great to get Thomas Ferguson to give us a sort of view of how other countries do it. Thomas Ferguson is professor of political science and political economy at the University of Massachusetts Boston, contributing editor for The Nation magazine, widely regarded as a leading expert on campaign finance. He's authored a variety of books, including Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Parties, and The Logic of Money-Driven Politics. Thomas Ferguson, thanks so much for joining us on The Breakdown.
Hi there.
Okay, so maybe let's start out with, let's kind of separate out China for a second. And
yeah, they don't, I mean, after all, you better have elections. Although, in fact, rulers take cash, which is an interesting point. You can actually gain some insight into this question by thinking of sort of sole rulers, you know, one person, which China's not, as sort of a limit case. And then actually look at the way those folks will, in many cases, snark enormous amounts of cash. Just this morning, if you, in the New York Times and other papers, there are stories about how the Gaddafi family runs Libya as a kind of kleptocracy.
Sure.
Very common in the third world, and it's a very interesting limit case for political finance.
That's great. Let's start with that as a limit case. A sole ruler, you know, something close to complete power, either a family or a small coterie or a single person. What does that look like in terms of, like, campaign finance, I guess is the wrong term, but how money in politics works?
Well, I actually think it sheds a lot of light on the general problem, which is if you have a monopoly ruler, he, or very rarely she, can snark everything there is to snark if they want. As soon, however, as you begin to get some political competition in the system, even if that's not formally electoral, even if there are sort of just power centers, you know, say, I mean, you could think of these in any number of ways, five or six groups. You could think of them just even sometimes as five or six different people in a kind of steering committee or something. The ability of one person to snark at all rapidly disintegrates. So that when you actually go to a sort of formally constitutional system with some rules, it might have changed. Even if it's not a democracy, your political finance situation is very likely to change. But you also won't usually see these astronomical examples like in Kazakhstan and elsewhere where the, you know, a ruler, the family becomes billionaires in 7 years or something like that.
Right. So it seems like the key thing you're pointing to here is competition, right? In a system in which there's complete monopoly of power by some sort of singular state entity, you don't have competing power sources. As soon as that begins to devolve towards something, even if it isn't devolve all the way to sort of genuine constitutional democracy, but something in which there's more checks and balances, more competing sources of power. Once that competition opens up, then people can attempt to use money to... How does that work? What does that transaction look like?
Well, it'll depend a lot on the specifics of the institution. And I mean, there are even cases of where folks will have friends and the friends take the cash. They don't give it directly to the ruler, but one way or the other. Or are the various competing power centers. You can get all kinds of intermediary situations. The point is that there are limits on what they can, you will forgive my plain English for the purposes of communication, steal in that situation. Now, let's move maybe to where you have some form of democratic state and a reasonable rule by law, of law. then you get to interesting situations. Let's just jump to sort of modern European cases, which I've actually studied a fair amount.
Great.
The first thing to notice in modern Europe, meaning post-1945, is that many of the political parties have a tighter definition of membership than the U.S. That is to say, you know, if you're a Democrat, you're a Democrat when you decide you're a Democrat. And nobody could imagine anybody in the Democratic Party telling you you're not a Democrat,
right,
can't have a membership card or stuff like that. In Europe, that's often not the case. And so the parties actually have formal members, and there are some dues associated with these, so that they can actually raise a fair amount of money right out of their members. In Europe after World War II, and very rarely before it, labor unions were much more solidly organized on a wider basis than the U.S., and they're often affiliated with some political party. And so you get a fair amount of, in effect, mass political financing actually hits those parties. I think to this day it makes a substantial difference in how they behave.
Interesting.
The striking thing, though, about most of the European system is that only in the last 20 years have they started to evolve toward U.S.-style massive lobbying, public relations, and most of the time, especially for, say, down to about 1970, most of the continental countries had some form of formalized policy process that actually blocked just anybody from getting in, for instance, to talk to ministers about laws. They're often highly formal systems where you got to get accredited to talk, and you get a kind of bargaining between the main social groups,
right,
which all have substantial amounts of money, even some of those representing ordinary people or a good chunk of the population. That can lead to outsider-insider problems, but it also leads to, it's very hard to imagine still in Western Europe, for example, anybody trying to cut basic social security or something like that, even though there's talk of it on the outside of those systems. It doesn't actually happen much, even with the current budgetary stringency.
Just to sort of make sure I'm tracking this, there seem to be two big differences that you're laying out in European democracies. The first is the strength of the party system. The parties have a kind of institutional heft, both in terms of what actually constitutes membership, the degree to which they're sort of integrated into the governing apparatus through coalition governments, and and sort of fused at times with labor unions, which also are sort of more robust mass institutions. All of that means that there's less room and less space for the kind of wealthy donors, corporate funding, and kind of freelancing interests to insert themselves.
On the other hand, in the last 20 years, the amount of cash the folks want to spend in elections, especially some with television, although not just the cost of TV that does this, there's also, you can see this very plainly, I think, in the leadership of most of these parties. They compare themselves with, frankly, CEOs, and they'd like to live like CEOs. The cash demands grow a lot. And, you know, I should add that in the right-wing parties, it's pretty common for parliamentarians to also say hold down corporate directorships directly. There's an element of sort of formal representation, if you like, built into that, that is, you know, you'd regard as just an errant conflict of interest in the United States situation, and frankly, it's an errant conflict of interest in the European one. But here's where I'm going with this. What you see in very large scale, it was always the case, if you go back and trace this, I've looked, for instance, in the German business records in the interwar period, and you could see it there, but it's pretty common to sort of, in effect, you can't finance the party directly, but you can finance, say, the office of the leader. Thus, for instance, Tony Blair, when he was running the Labour Party before he became Prime Minister, it eventually came out that he was, in effect, on a kind of payroll arrangement with BP and a string of other companies. There's one excellent book on this, Labour Party PLC, that virtually nobody has ever heard of in the United States. But it sort of brings this stuff out. You also see this type of thing in France and I think in Germany, too. In the German case, you know, it eventually came out that Helmut Kohl, the so-called system Kohl there, was raising enormous amounts of money from businesses just himself, and he was using it for party purposes. I mean, I used to wonder, and I had a few fights with German academics in the 1980s, saying the fact that nobody ever challenged Kohl told me that there was some unseen force at work in the Christian Democratic Party, because the real parties don't have zero opposition. And they used to say I was crazy. And then it turned out, you know, eventually when the East German wiretaps came out, that's exactly what was happening. You can read stuff like this if you're skilled at it.
So the point is that even with these kind of institutional bulwarks, there are places in which the kind of transactional nature of the injection of money into politics by particularly business interests, wealthy interests, can still find a way into it. But the other point that you're making that I want to just make sure that our listeners are clear on is that the actual policy making apparatus in European parliamentary systems is much more based on the civil service and is much less a product of the raw kind of hand-to-hand combat of politics, because there's a much more sort of professionalized policy making apparatus. And that does insulate a bit, or used to insulate a bit, the policy making process from the intervention of moneyed lobbyists.
Now, that's exactly the point. But I would add that this is everywhere breaking down. And there's a very simple way to sort of show this. If you graph, I mean, I've actually done a paper on this. Well, Rob Johnson and I did a paper for the last INET conference where we effectively, what we did was we plotted the salaries of civil servants in the U.S. that regulate finance against financial salaries. And of course, what you find is an explosive divergence after the 1970s. The situation in Europe is not quite as bad, but it's pretty much the same. In effect, what I'm telling you is that sheer inequality operates as a kind of powerful magnetic force that hits institutions. That, you know, that's not directly political finance at all. It's not a campaign contribution. But what it tends to do is to make your civil servants, even if they still stick in careers, which, you know, in the U.S. they don't. In the U.S., they're virtually short-term employment agencies for whoever you're regulating. I mean, they sort of get their pick of that, and then they just hire from that. But even in Europe, you will see this steady outflow of folks there, and it absolutely affects the quality of the regulation. I mean, in that same paper of ours where we looked at who regulated banks, made a serious effort to crimp bank compensation in the wake of the bailouts there, what we found is there are only two things that made any difference. One was the percentage of the population that voted. The other one was the strength of the socialist parties in parliament.
So that's a really interesting and broadly applicable point about the fact that inequality in and of itself begins to sort of loosen some of the bonds of the institutional structure.
That's right.
And there's something kind of autocatalytic about that, right? I mean, it's a vicious circle insofar as those bonds get loosened, it confers greater power
yep.
on the people that are reaping the gains from the increasing inequality and therefore pushes through policies which then tend to exacerbate same inequality, et cetera.
Yep.
So I want to turn finally to a slightly narrower question in terms, and we'll stick with the sort of Europe-US comparison about the actual sort of legal regime of regulation. When I was in Switzerland, I guess it was a year ago, and we met, I was with a group that met with a bunch of parliamentary leaders, and they basically said there is no formal campaign finance structure or campaign finance regulation in Swiss politics, and in fact, there's no donation limits and there's no disclosure. And so I said to them, wait a second, Nestle could give you $100,000 just sort of wired anonymously, and then you go vote on something that affects Nestle? And they said yes, but then they said that would never happen. And what was interesting to me was that it seemed that, I can't obviously speak to whether it works or not, but the system...
Yeah, I actually know about the Swiss system, so let me just quick jump in here.
Yeah, please.
First of all, they've had a long history of the most errant conflicts of interest. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, it was very common for the parliamentary deputies to be working, for example, for railways and things like that. I'm not exactly sure about their rules on directorships. I believe the parliamentarians can hold them. You see a lot of that stuff. In general, though, there's a whole structure of Swiss politics, because it's built on a compromise between groups. They tend to sort of force all the politics out of the federal part of the system down into, you know, the cantons, the various sort of local areas. And, you know, I think anybody who knows that stuff, you know, I'm pretty fluent in German and I've had Swiss friends, and no, these folks, the climate is one that is sort of an unsympathetic being like myself would say. So many people are bought, it's like they don't even realize they're bought. And you continually run into these cases if you study them in Switzerland, where, for example, everybody will agree, for example, the way that the Swiss dealt with Jewish property after World War II was a scandal. Nobody seems to have squawked in that political system. Guess why? There were bank ties all over the place. You also have in Switzerland a situation where as it came out during the financial crisis, the two biggest banks own maybe a third of everything there is to own, directly and indirectly, in the country. That was the too big to fail problem in Swiss guys. Chris, if I could, let me make one last point about the Europe-U.S. differences, which is pretty interesting, which is in the U.S., thanks to the Gilded Age and the colossal fortunes, you got large foundations emerged as the threat of taxation began to creep up. And those foundations got into sort of public policy real fast, like Rockefeller, Russell Sage, you know, Carnegie and others. In Europe, this foundation business has tended to be much smaller, and the bigger sort of funding for policy think tanks comes typically from stuff that's formally affiliated with political parties. That has one great advantage. Everybody knows it's political, and nobody pretends other than that. And that's the American public space is substantially different from Europe, because the fiction here is that, you know, foundations and think tanks are not in politics. That's absurd. But, you know, there we have it. So the institutional differences, and particularly the way in which, you know, wealth gets constrained or not by other social groups, are really important in working through the terms of political competition.
Finally, it does seem like there's something of a sort of paradox here, which is that the U.S. seems to regulate the actual flow of funds probably more closely than any other industrialized democracy. I don't know if that's the case, but that is my sense. And yet, it also seems like money has as much of an effect here as I could imagine in any industrialized democracy. Do you think that's more or less the case, or am I wrong about that?
Well, what I'd say is that our folks make a big effort of show. But when you study the campaign finance, you see, for instance, the way you have to sort of cut through all the fog, which most campaign finance analysts sort of carry on endlessly about the role of small donors. When you actually walk through that, you find that that's just nonsensical, that all of them, from Obama on down, rely largely on big money, one way or the other. The only place where you get some financial regulation, which quickly broke down, was on the individual presidential financial contributions, and for that matter, individual congressional contributions. Very quickly, political action committees, soft money, 527s, so-called independent spending, now with Citizens United, you can just do direct right out of the corporate treasury. That stuff is the Amazon of political finance. The individual contribution business, especially after McCain-Feingold, that 2002 bill, where they upped the limits to the point where lots of donors now max out at around 60 or 64,000. At that point, you're into really big money. What you have here is, to be perfectly blunt, a kind of smokescreen. I often compare it to Hollywood regulation of movies in the 20s that said sex, violence, and nudity was supposed to be regulated. And then, of course, what you got were just tons of sex, violence, and nudity. That's, I'm afraid, where we're really at. The level of fake regulation here, helped along by an amazingly friendly and compliant press that simply will not investigate this stuff in any serious way, is, it's apparent.
Let me end on this note, which is to ask if there is a country that you've encountered that seems to do a good job on this score, to have some mix of informal norms, institutional structures, and formal regulations that produces a kind of close to optimal mix.
I think that, say, some of the Northern European, Germany, parts of Scandinavia, 50s and 60s, might have approached that. Now, everywhere, that system is breaking down. And so what you actually have under globalization is a vast tide of money washing through the whole world. That tide rolls right through the political systems of these countries, too, sometimes helped along by direct satellite broadcasts, so that, you know, equal time provisions and things like that that people wrote in their constitutions are utterly meaningless. I mean, Rupert Murdoch's satellite reaches you whether you like it or not.
Thomas Ferguson is professor of political science and political economy at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He is an expert on campaign finance and the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Parties and the Logic of Money-Driven Politics. Professor Ferguson, thanks so much for joining us on The Breakdown.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
The Breakdown is a weekly production of The Nation Magazine and TheNation.com. New audio casts are posted each Friday at TheNation.com and available on iTunes. The Breakdown was produced by Ryan Rafferty and yours truly. Senior producers of The Nation are Frank Reynolds and Emily Douglas. You should send comments and feedback to TheBreakdown@TheNation.com. We've been getting a ton of them and really appreciate it. Keep it coming.
gonna run to? Where you gonna run to? All on that day.